Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this press conference at the Palais des Nations in Geneva, which is currently hosting the 55th regular session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. We are very pleased to have with us Ms. Francesca Albanese, who's the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. The United Nations Human Rights Council appointed Francesca Albanese as the holder of this mandate on April 1st, 2022. Since the start of her mandate, Ms. Albanese has presented four reports, two to the UN General Assembly and two others to the UN Human Rights Council. She presented her latest report yesterday to the Human Rights Council and participated in an interactive dialogue with UN member states and non-governmental organizations. The Special Rapporteur will first make opening remarks and before taking your questions. Ms. Albanese, vous avez la parole.
Merci. Bonjour à toutes et tous. After 5 months of monitoring and analyzing Israel's onslaught on Gaza, my report finds that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating that Israel is committing the crime of genocide against the Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with a requisite intent, killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, and deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The flagrant and systematic slaughter of Palestinian civilians, the deployment of unlawful weaponry, the utter obliteration of vital civilian infrastructure, including the deliberate targeting of all Gaza's hospitals and the man-made starvation of the Palestinian people transcend the realm of war crimes and crimes against humanity that had been seen in the occupied Palestinian territory before. The monstrosity unfolding is accompanied by a pervasive anti-Palestinian narrative and dehumanization emanating from the uppermost tiers of Israeli society, including high-ranking officials with command authority and frequently reflected in soldiers' actions on the ground. This reflects the intent, a dolus specialis, to destroy in whole or in part, which is what distinguishes genocide from other atrocity crimes. In the case of Gaza, there exists a chilling clarity of this purpose, the systematic eradication of an entire people, or at least a significant part thereof. One of the key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted, using Bellow principles, subvertive their protection functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. The only reasonable inference that can be drawn from the unveiling of this policy is an Israeli state policy of genocidal violence toward the Palestinian people in Gaza. I will now be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Albanese. We'll first take questions from the room. Reuters, please.
Madam Special Rapporteur, thank you. Just wondering on a personal level for you, given how vocal you have been and how some of your statements might not please certain people, have you received any threats, any attempts at intimidation while working on this report? Thank you.
Thank you for your concern. I mean, it's been a difficult time. I've been attacked since the very beginning of my mandate. I don't say that it's been a pleasant journey, but I can tell you it's much more. I mean, most of the pain comes from where I have to observe and monitor and investigate day by day. Yeah, I do receive threats. Nothing that so far I have considered needing extra precautions. Pressure, yes, and it doesn't change either my commitment or the results of my work, I think.
Yes, Moussa Assi, Al-Mayadeen TV, please.
Merci beaucoup. Madame Albanese, vous avez évoqué des génocides depuis 1948 ou 1947. Et cela a fait beaucoup d'écho du côté israélien. Comment vous pouvez nous expliquer donc votre point de vue concernant cette hypothèse? Donc le massacre qui ont été commis en 1947 avant la création d'Israël, ou bien après, ou bien comment ça a déroulé cette hypothèse? Merci.
Je m'excuse, mais je n'ai pas vraiment compris la première partie de votre question. C'est quelle hypothèse?
Dans votre rapport, vous avez parlé des actes des génocides depuis la création d'Israël.
Non, je n'ai pas fait ça. Non. Je suis désolée, je n'ai pas fait ça.
D'accord. Alors
D'autres l'ont fait, mais si vous avez bien lu mon rapport, oui. Je pense que ce n'est pas le cas, parce que je n'ai jamais évoqué ça. Je parlais d'une autre chose. Je dis que, et je l'ai bien mis dans le contexte de l'histoire, le génocide, ce n'est pas un acte, c'est un processus. Et l'histoire coloniale est pleine de idéologie et pratiques génocidaires, parce qu'ils visent à l'élimination des peuples indigènes, des peuples autochtones. La Palestine a expérimenté, le peuple palestinien en Palestine a expérimenté ces pratiques dès le début. Je n'ai pas conclu que c'est du génocide dès le début, mais clairement, c'est des pratiques éliminatoires. Parce que ce que les Palestiniens sont en train d'expérimenter aujourd'hui, c'est nouveau et choquant pour ceux qui ne connaissent pas l'histoire de la Palestine. Mais la destruction des villages, le dépeuplement forcé, être chassé, désintégré en tant que peuple, c'est quelque chose qui est la Nakba. La Nakba, c'est ce que les Palestiniens ont vécu depuis le 1947. Et encore, le 1967, personne n'en parle. Mais destruction des villages, dépeuplement forcé, ce qu'ils ont vécu. C'est pour ça que je dis, c'est pas tout à fait nouveau. Mais non, on a atteint un niveau qu'on ne peut plus ignorer. On a un crime qui est là. Une définition légale. Il faut simplement considérer ce qui se passe aujourd'hui, et peut-être que d'autres vont faire l'analyse de ce si c'était déjà un génocide de 1947. C'est pas mon cas, mais je suis très convaincue de ce que j'écris dans le rapport pour maintenant.
Before we take questions from journalists online, Jan Dirk Eberman, Tiger Spiegel.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to ask you on the intent of the Israeli government or Israeli militaries to commit genocide. You're saying that there is intent, and you're quoting the president of Israel, the prime minister, the defense minister, and some top militaries. But these are only quotes given in speeches or in other circumstances. I would like to ask you, do you have a written document by the government with a clear intent to commit genocide?
Do you think that in Rwanda and in Bosnia-Herzegovina, any government officials wrote a document saying, I want to commit genocide? Have you seen anything like that? I'll answer this for you. No, it doesn't work like that. Those statements are just the tip of the iceberg, because I have a word limit in my reports, which is quite strict. Otherwise, we could write an encyclopedia with what has been said and done. And I said it, and I mean it. If the International Criminal Court is serious about investigating what Israel has done in Gaza, as of the 7th of October, only as of the 7th of October, it will be busy for decades. Looking at the previous genocides and jurisprudence that has been developed on those cases, it's clear that The intent can be direct in statements, public statements, declarations, having people with command authority, or having the prime minister, and having the president of the state issuing statements. They are so dehumanizing, evoking violence. Not once, not twice, continuously for months. It's supported by jurisprudence in other cases that this is genocidal incitement. And look what, it's been reflected, it has reverberated across the conduct of troops on the ground. They've used the same words, Amalek. Amalek is a program in itself. And then, as you say, are there documents? If you read my report, you will see that I've quoted official documents, legal analysis, that the legal justification that Israel uses. There are two, one version and then an updated version with the key legal findings. And it's exactly what I said. It's humanitarian camouflage, because they justify what they're doing using IHL categories, evacuations and human shields. Everyone is a human shield. Everyone is a human shield. Women, children, anything that is between the troops and whatever is their objective. And by the way, the overall objective, eradicating Hamas, destroying Hamas, which is, it's not even a real military objective. Because one thing is to neutralize, destroy the military capacity of an organization. Another thing is to target also the civilian components. And this is what has been done. Every Hamas affiliate has been considered targetable, killable, and so their family members. This explains the 30,000 people who have been killed plus. I mean, this is a conservative figure I'm referring to.
Nina Larson, AFP.
Yes. Thank you for taking my question. Over here. I was wondering if you could say something about the countries that are providing weapons and other support to Israel. You've called for an arms embargo and sanctions, but what responsibility did those countries carry for providing the weapons up until now? And now that you've called for this, and you're saying that this is a fairly clear requirement, what is their responsibility if they continue? If you could say something about that. Thank you.
Yes, I formulated that recommendation because this is a clear emanation of the Genocide Convention. When there is a risk of genocide, there are obligations that are immediately have to be followed. So there are different things, but suspending arms transfer, suspending weapons transfer is necessary in order to reduce the level of hostilities and violence against civilians. After the 26th of January's ICJ interim ruling, there was no doubt whatsoever that was the obligation pending on all states. And this has not been acted upon. So I didn't formulate. Of course, we know who's the main political and also economic supporter of Israel. So, of course, the eye and the mind immediately goes to the United States, but there are other states. And I intend to look further into this, so probably my next report will be on this topic, on the issue of responsibility.
We'll go to journalists who are participating online, starting with Antonio Brotto,
EFE.
Sorry.
I just wanted to follow up. I'm sorry. I just wanted to check. Would you say that they could be considered complicit in the genocide that you've seen?
This is not something that I can conclude right now, but the risk is there. And there are already legal proceedings that have been started in the United States for example, by the Center for Constitutional Rights. So, but I'm not in a position to conclude that as well.
Okay, we'll move to journalists who are attending this press conference online, starting with Antonio Broto, Spanish news agency, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask if you think that your conclusions should accelerate the verdict of International Court of Justice regarding genocide in Gaza. Some say that it could take years for them to make a decision, but do you think it could be faster? Thank you.
I do not know if this will accelerate the proceedings of the court. I imagine that my report brings to the fore an important piece of analysis, which is what I called humanitarian camouflage. Because the tendency is to look at what Israel has done as as isolated war crimes. And this is why I say, well, if we take a step back and look at the full picture, and for once we try not to miss the forest for the trees, we get it. Also because it's been said, it's, as I said, the intent is so ostentatious. I mean, they're already planning how to rebuild Gaza for the settlers. It's shocking. And so probably that will provide further analytical elements. But my objective as a special rapporteur is not necessarily to influence the court, is to make sure the member states comply with international law, because it's not an act of charity. It's an international obligation they have. And a society which accepts to depart from international law, it's a society, and I talk about the international community, which accepts to face barbarity, because this is when we leave the use of force unchecked rule our international order.
A second question online from Yuri Aprelev, RIA Novosti, Russian news agency.
Oui, bonjour et merci pour ce briefing. Je vais vous poser la question en français, si vous n'êtes pas contre. Dans vos courtes remarques préliminaires, vous avez dit que trois faits laissaient penser qu'un génocide était commis à Gaza. Le premier que vous avez évoqué, c'est la mort massive de civils. Le deuxième que vous avez évoqué, c'est les conditions inhumaines qui sont imposées à la population palestinienne. Et je n'ai pas le troisième, raison pour laquelle je vous pose la question. Et je voulais aussi savoir si ces conditions s'appliquent uniquement à Gaza ou si elles concernent aussi la Cisjordanie. Merci.
It's on. Yeah. Et oui, alors, il y a trois actes que j'ai cités dans le rapport. C'est killings, sorry. Infliger de la souffrance physique et mentale à la population, à un membre du groupe, et la création de conditions qui rendraient la vie impossible aux membres du groupe. Et de nouveau, tout l'ensemble, dans la préparation du rapport, c'était difficile pour moi de vraiment distinguer d'analyser séparément les différents éléments, parce qu'ils sont tellement l'un dans l'autre, c'est-à-dire priver la population d'hôpitaux, d'anesthétiques. Et c'est soit causé de la douleur aux enfants et aux autres adultes qui ont été amputés sans anesthésie. Vous voyez, c'est une chose incroyable. Mais à la fois, c'est aussi créer les conditions à la population pour ne pas pouvoir vivre. On ne sait pas encore combien de gens sont morts parce qu'il n'y avait pas des hôpitaux et il n'y avait pas la possibilité de se soigner. Normalement, c'est pour ça que c'est finalement ça seront les tribunaux qui de toutes les façons vont confirmer tout ce qui s'est passé dans le détail, mais ça c'était disons ma conclusion.
Une troisième question en ligne, Nick Cumming-Bruce, The New York Times, before we go back to the room.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking the question. Your report includes a recommendation for deploying an international protective presence. I wondered if you could just dig into that, explain what it is you got in mind, and say whether or not you've engaged and had any discussions with states on that particular issue, where the thinking is going on that. And a second question, just following up on my colleagues, you say it's too soon for you to determine whether states providing arms are complicit in commission of war crimes or potentially genocide. Could you just explain a little bit what the reasoning there is? I mean, on one hand, we've got states that are providing weapons that are being used directly in the hostilities that you say may amount to acts of genocide. So what's holding you back from identifying complicity? Thank you.
What holds me back from referring to complicity is that I've not investigated this. I mean, I don't throw claims out there on things, on matters that I've not investigated, as simple as that. Although, I say, it's under our watch. But if it's so much under our watch, why other responsible actors do not intervene? So I will, as I said, I will investigate this, and unless other, I mean, there are no other urgent priorities. And I apologize to the journalist before, because he asked me another piece of question, and I hope he won't mind me answering in English. But no, I've not looked at whether genocide, the crime of genocide, extends to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But again, the problem is that here there is genocide is committed against a group in whole or in part, and here the attack is against the Palestinians as a people, where they are still a fracture of the international orders that hits the people as such, so not the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people in Gaza. I must apologize, but I didn't. I'm sorry. I'm also extremely sick today, and it's a bit painful to be here. So I apologize, but I will ask you to repeat the first part of the question because I missed it.
Yeah, sure. It was the reference in your report to the deployment of an international protective presence. What did you have in mind, and have you had any discussion with people? What's the thinking around that? Thank you.
Yes, of course. Those who have followed my work since I became a special rapporteur know that I've been recommending the establishment of a protective presence for a long time now. And I will tell you what I mean, but let me tell you before that anyone I've engaged with, states and UN alike, roll their eyes when I say that. To say Israel will never accept it. And at what point will we be able to draw a line and say, enough, you cannot decide everything without consequences? It clearly doesn't work. Condemning Israel and saying that Israel doesn't respect international law is not enough. So what I mean by protective presence, it's an international presence, meaning people who are neither Israelis nor Palestinians, who are apart, outside of the, let's say, the conflict dynamic, although for me this that the word conflict is not necessarily accurate to describe what happens. But if we need a force that interposes itself between the Palestinians and Israeli citizens, because there are so many, not enough, but so many Israelis who are engaged with the Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, with shepherds and trying to... Like, they are a protective presence. They go... So this is the thing that should be done, making sure that pending the withdrawal of Israel's military presence in the occupied Palestinian territory, there is a shelter between the Palestinians and the Israelis, settlers, armed settlers, and the army, so that because their physical integrity now is more at risk than ever. And so this could take, I mean, I was not necessarily thinking of blue helmets, but it could also be the passive presence, as passive presence, as it was called in the 90s, that UNRWA refugee affairs officers used to engage with. So just people who go there and make sure that there is no harm done, because now the violence has escalated to a point that is really unacceptable.
Thank you. We'll go back to the room with Satoko Adachi, Yomiuri Shimbun, then the lady in the back, and Al Jazeera, and John.
Thank you very much for doing this. Yesterday at the council, very few Western delegation took the floor, and I just wondering if you have received any reaction from your report, especially those countries who support Israel militarily, and if that is the case, what is their reaction?
I think it's too soon to say. Personally, I'm looking at my team. I mean, I've not received anything in particular that I can signal. I think that the absence of many Western states, some really surprised me, speak for itself. They decide where to sit in this, and they should be questioned about that. But sooner or later, I mean, there will be a reaction, I suppose.
Thank you. Actually, we heard a lot about raping Israeli women. This narrative, Israeli narrative, did you receive any evidences that it happened? And from the other side, we also received many reports and heard a lot of Palestinian delegations saying that Israeli occupation army raped Palestinian women in Gaza and inside the prisons also. Can you confirm any of both narratives? Do you have any evidences about this? And did any of both sides used rape as a war weapon? Thank you.
Your name and your media.
Yes, my name is Dina Abisab. I'm a reporter of several Arabic media. Thank you.
I'm not entirely comfortable with the term narrative, and I'm sure it's done in good faith. But it's the fact that rape occurs in context of hostilities or heightened animosity and conflict, I mean, even at the social level, it happens. So I was not surprised to hear allegations and instances of rape. And I've expressed since the very beginning my solidarity with all victims. And it's clear that it takes time for women to elaborate, to process what they've gone through. What I was very disturbed by was the weaponization of anything that has happened on the 7th of October. Personally, I have not received information. I've read reports that have been written. I didn't find any convincing evidence, but this doesn't mean that I believe that rape didn't occur. This is for what happened in Israel. Special rapporteurs have received allegations of rape against Palestinian women, not only Palestinian women and men, in detention centers, or while deprived of their liberties. Because this is a conference, I'm not going to go in detail about that, but yes, we received this, and we have inquired with the Israeli authorities. We have also denounced it publicly because it was of serious concern, among other crimes being committed against the Palestinians. And, we shall see.
Hafez Moriba, Al Jazeera. Mike.
Okay. Mrs. Albanese, how do you answer some countries like the United States who are more or less skeptical towards your report? And some American officials said that there is no evidence that genocide has been committed in Gaza.
Thank you.
Let's agree that we disagree. I do believe that the evidence is significant, is cogent, as I said in the report, and also, I mean, I don't find this statement particularly surprising, considering where it comes from. So it's like, let me not make reference to metaphors today, because I'm not in a great shape. So, but frankly, they are not an impartial voice in this respect. So,
John Zarakostas, France 24.
Hi, this is for my other outlet, The Lancet. I was wondering, Special Rapporteur, can you elaborate a little bit more on the humanitarian camouflage and other case studies from violations in the field in recent years where similar policies have been enacted by armed groups or governments or military? And secondly, how much were you inspired in your research by General Maxwell Taylor and the Nuremberg tribunals? Thank you.
By humanitarian camouflage, I mean the use, the misuse, the distortion of international humanitarian law, principles of proportionality, distinction, precautions have been invoked. I mean, Israel has justified, has explained its military actions as proportionate, as not targeting civilians. They didn't achieve their goal, considering that 70% of the victims have steadily been women and children throughout the assault on Gaza. And so there has been an abuse of these categories. And in the report, I made reference to human shields, medical shielding, evacuation orders and safe zones, and collateral damage. I won't have the time now to elaborate on each and every one of them, but just to pick one, human shields. The use of human shields is prohibited under international law. So, and it occurs when military action takes place behind civilians, so as to use them as a shield. And of course it's prohibited. The point that is that Israel has used the concept of the allegation of Palestinian armed groups using human shields since the very beginning of its military campaigns against Gaza in 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014, 2020, 2012, 2014, 2021, 2022, and including during the Great March of Return. So, and these allegations have proven false to a certain point. Even Israel, in certain instances, Israel had to retract those allegations, and this is documented in the report. So, I'm saying that this is not new. It has been used at an unprecedented level this time, because, again, on everything has been justified, and it's very overwhelming. It's overwhelming in the Israeli explanations and documents that Hamas uses human shields. And so instead of doing what IHL requires, so providing evidence that in each attack that's were not avoidable because it was Hamas using human shields, The very configuration of Gaza's population has been considered human shielding. But also, and this is the last element I wanted to bring to this, how military targets, because this is what happens to the people, how military targets have been considered. So first of all, there is a pattern that allows to say that not just combatants have been targeted. And in order to be a legitimate target, you need to be an active combatant. A soldier, and I say that in general, including an Israeli soldier who's not an active combat, cannot be targeted because he's a civilian at that point. And so it's a crime to target anyone who's not in active combat. But also the physical targets have been identified through an AI system on using criteria that have led to target an entire building, for example, based on the presumption that a Hamas affiliate had been there. And this is, so there was no military purpose to target the entire building. And of course, and there is overwhelming evidence of how medical premises have been destroyed on this basis, on using false allegations that then have proven wrong, and still this has not spared any facility from the military attack.
Merci. Nous allons prendre deux questions via Zoom, en commençant par Jérémy Lanche, Radio France Internationale, s'il vous plaît.
Merci, Pascal. Bonjour, Madame Albanaise. Je vais vous faire repasser en français, je m'excuse si ça ne vous dérange pas trop, une question rapide. Est-ce que vous nourrissez l'espoir, un peu fou peut-être, que votre rapport va accroître la pression sur Israël d'une telle manière que la conduite des opérations va peut-être changer pour le reste du conflit, ou bien c'est totalement illusoire de penser ça?
Évidemment, si je n'avais pas cet espoir fou, comme vous dites, je travaillerai pas. C'est-à-dire, mon but finalement, c'est de voir la fin de cette violence sans sens. Et si ça va se passer, je peux pas le dire, mais j'espère que oui. Et ça se passera pas sans la réaction forte des membres des Nations Unies qui doivent, comme je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, ils doivent respecter les obligations émanant du droit international qu'ils ont signé. Parce que maintenant, c'est pas un acte de charité et de solidarité avec le peuple palestinien. C'est des obligations du droit international que tous les États ont. Voilà.
Thank you. Another question online from Christian Ulrich, DPA, German News Agency.
Merci, Pascal. Et retour en anglais, Madame Albanaise, s'il vous plaît. You are being criticized and vilified so much, including for your outspokenness and your media presence. Does being so outspoken not make it more difficult for you to fulfill your mandate? Have you ever considered being less vocal, or is it conceivable that the criticism might force you to consider stepping down? Thank you.
No way. It will never happen, I can tell you. I mean, it's making me sick a little bit, I can say, but it's not the criticism. Frankly, it doesn't change my work. Does it? Do you see any effect on it, frankly, media people in the room? No, because on the contrary, can I use a non-UN term word? No, better not. No, it just infuriates me. It pisses me off. Of course it does. But then it creates even more pressure not to step back. Because, you know, human rights work is first and foremost amplifying the voice of people who are not heard. And the Palestinians are not unique in this sense. This is the fate of the non-West, but non-Western people. So I find so insulting to dismiss what the Palestinians are going through, as many, including your colleagues in the West, are doing. Now it starts to change. It took the life of 30,000 people for some media, for some journalists to realize what's happening and to stop asking, do you condemn Hamas? Of course one condemns Hamas. How not to condemn Hamas? But at the same time, nothing justifies what Israel is doing. So, yeah, I need to say that, and I will continue to say that. And I mean, I might decide at some point to step out simply because I also have a private life that I would like to enjoy, but not, it won't be because they vilify or they mistreat me in the, yeah, in the public discourse.
Thank you. A question from Jamie Keaton from AP or American in Paris.
Hello, Madam Albanese. I really just wanted to, you made a response to Jeremy in French, and I just wanted to see if you could say a little bit more about what you hope to achieve by the issuance of this report. Thank you.
What I wrote in the recommendations, arms embargoes and sanctions, because there is no other way. Of course, what I want to see is the end of the hostilities and peace in that land for the Palestinians and Israelis, because when it happens, it will be a wonderful place. But it's really far. And because Israel is not going to change its pattern on its own, and it won't stop by inertia, I urged member states to take measures, and it's necessary. So what I want to see is sanctions and arms embargo as soon as possible, as it's been done with other states which violate an international law. Voilà.
Okay, on revient dans la salle avec Boris d'abord et ensuite Louisa. Ah, Louisa. Louisa Balin, Global Geneva Insights, please.
Merci, Pascal. Bonjour, Madame Albanese. Qu'est-ce que vous attendez de la Suisse, dépositaire des conventions de Genève, notamment? Qu'est-ce que vous attendez donc de la Suisse, surtout par rapport à l'UNRWA aussi? Qu'est-ce que vous attendez des pays et qu'est-ce que vous demandez aux pays, notamment de l'Union européenne? Et qu'est-ce que vous demandez aux États-Unis? Merci.
Alors, je pars avec la question générale. Je pense que ce que je me répète, ce que je demande à tout État, c'est de prendre les mesures nécessaires pour se conformer au droit international et en particulier à la Convention sur le génocide qui pose des obligations sur les États. Prendre toutes mesures pour empêcher qu'un génocide soit commis. Maintenant, je trouve que le génocide a été déjà commis. Le problème est qu'on peut encore sauver des vies. Et on peut encore, c'est-à-dire on peut se freiner et arrêter la descente vers l'abysse, quoi. Et ça, en général, bon, ce que je m'attends qu'il se passe aux États-Unis, c'est peut-être un miracle qu'il écoute aussi leur peuple, parce que il y a même partout, il y a des protestes et des gens qui demandent le cessez-le-feu permanent, bien sûr la libération des otages et la libération de toute personne détenue arbitrairement. Il y a des milliers de Palestiniens dans cette situation maintenant. Et voilà, je pense que ça, c'est quelque chose qui concerne tous les États. À l'Union européenne en particulier, je pense que finalement, c'est nécessaire de suspendre l'accord d'association, les partenariats qu'ils ont avec l'État d'Israël. Vous voyez, parfois, je me retrouve avec des États qui me disent « Eh mais non, quand même, on a mis l'identification que les produits des colonies viennent des colonies. » Oui, mais pourquoi ces produits sont sur vos marchés en premier lieu? Parce que ce sont l'émanation d'un crime de guerre. Ils ne devraient même pas rentrer dans les marchés européens. Et voilà, il y a eu toute cette tendance à normaliser la monstruosité, l'abnormalité qui est une occupation qui dure depuis 56 ans. Et voilà, il faut qu'ils se réveillent et ils changent de démarche. Qu'est-ce que je m'attends de la Suisse? Et là, je vais dire aussi une chose qui concerne les autres États membres, surtout ceux-là qui ont suspendu les financements à le Hongrie. Et c'est très grave, il faut le réinstaller, il faut garder. Je sais qu'en Suisse, il y a eu un débat s'il faut continuer à soutenir le Hongrie, mais ça, c'est pas récent. Ça dure depuis longtemps. Et il y a beaucoup de désinformations, mais aussi une amnésie sur c'est quoi le Hongrie. Et c'est quoi le rôle de l'Assemblée générale? Ça, c'est pas une. Le futur de Hongrie ne repose pas dans les. C'est-à-dire, on ne peut pas se déterminer au niveau d'État individuel. S'ils ne sont pas contents avec le Hongrie, il faut discuter au sein de l'agence de l'Assemblée générale. Parce que c'est l'Assemblée générale qui a le mandat, qui a le pouvoir de changer le mandat de Hongrie. Et voilà, la Suisse est aussi un pays qui s'est toujours dit neutre et neutralité ne signifie pas silence absolu. Il faut prendre des décisions qui ne signifient pas se rentrer dans la dynamique politique du conflit. Mais là, le niveau de violations qui ont été commis contre les civils à Gaza en particulier impose une prise de position forte. Parce que l'article Common Article 1, l'article 1 des conventions de Genève, parle de respecter, obligation de respecter et assurer le respect du droit international humanitaire. Et ça, je le vois pas ni en Suisse ni ailleurs.
We have a follow-up question from Jamie online. Jamie, please go ahead.
Thanks, Pascal. Ms. Ablanevis, I wanted to just refer back to you the response from the Israeli diplomatic mission here in Geneva. In their statement on Monday after the release of your report, they said that you were behind a, quote, campaign of delegitimizing the very creation and existence of the State of Israel. And they said that they accused you of excusing and legitimizing the attacks of October 7th and dismissing their anti-Semitic nature. Among other things. But I just wanted to know if you could respond to those allegations, please. Thank you.
No, I'm not behind nor in front of any campaign to delegitimize the State of Israel. But if you want to, if we want to use this expression, I'm part of a movement which wants the end of the apartheid, which wants that Israel behaves and lives in accordance with international law. Is it that such an affront to expect that Israel, member of the United Nations, whose existence I've never questioned, behaves like it should as a member of the United Nations that respects international law? Because this is the point. I don't question, for the record, now and for the future, I do not question the existence of the State of Israel. I say today that Israel cannot behave as it does, as an apartheid state, and face no consequences. And the second thing is that there is amnesia that the State of Israel, around the birth of the State of Israel, because it was the outcome not just of one tragedy, but it's connected to two tragedies. And one is very well known and absorbed, which is the tragedy, the horror of the Holocaust. The other, what it meant for the native people of Palestine, the creation of the State of Israel, dispossession, forced displacement, and this is history. This is history. Even Israeli historians have written that. Benny Morris, first and foremost. So, no, I mean, again, I'm accused because I'm someone who doesn't suffer from historical amnesia. That's it. Anti-Semitism. Everyone who dares uttering a word of criticism against Israel is accused of anti-Semitism. I've said it from the very beginning of my mandate. This is so dangerous. This is so dangerous, first and foremost, for Jewish communities wherever they are. Because I do understand why every Jew, I mean, there are many Jews who are critical of Israel, but there are many who feel such love and such deep connection with Israel, which is fine. It's okay. This is not up to us to judge. Those who I judge are member states. But at the same time, using every kind of argument that is made again, against Israeli practices of apartheid and right now, in my view, the genocidal practices that Israel is displaying is accused. I mean, accusing everyone of anti-Semitism reveals bad faith. Because, frankly, what has been scandalous and shocking to many, which led Israel to finally officialize its policy of PNGing special rapporteurs, in my case, is that I don't find any evidence that what was caused on what the crimes that were committed against Israelis on the 7th of October were propelled by anti-Semitism, which doesn't mean, and I issued a statement on that, which doesn't mean that there is no anti-Semitic sentiment in any of those who participated in the attack. This I cannot know. But saying that the 7th of October was caused by anti-Semitism makes two things. On the one hand, as also Jewish scholars themselves have said, take out of the context completely Israel's responsibilities in creating the conditions that have led to the violence that animated those who the violence that was committed against Israeli civilians on October 7. And the second, it maintains this. It feeds this discourse that Israel is facing an existential threat because the Palestinians are anti-Semitic and therefore each means is justified. This is absolutely outrageous. And this is what's happening. And I was so disappointed to see that this is not only an argument made by Israel. This is amplified by Western media and Western politicians. So yeah, and sometimes I'm not particularly strategic in how I pick my fights. But I'm happy I did what I did, saying, I'm sorry, this is not anti-Semitism, and I face the consequences, and I'm still alive.
Ms. Albanese has a tight schedule. We have time for one last question, if there's any. If not, do you have any concluding remarks?
Just thank you. No concluding remarks.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Special Rapporteur, and thank you to all of you for attending this press conference and for your interest in the work of the Special Rapporteur. Thank you.